Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Today we're exploring the impact of a profound shift in American life. The fact that we're having fewer children than ever before. And fewer people becoming parents mean fewer older Americans are becoming grandparents. For many, the idea of becoming a nana or a pop-pop feels like more than a wish, more than a want. It becomes a chance to reconnect with the joy of watching tiny humans develop, build stronger family bonds, find purpose later in life. Others have made peace with having grand dogs instead of grandkids. Today on All Sides, we're going to explore all the ways this shift towards fewer children impacts the emotional landscape of aging. We begin with Krista Westrick Payne. She's an assistant director of the National Center for Family and Marriage Research at Bowling Green State University. Welcome to All Sides, Krista.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the statistics. The most recent data collected by the Centers for Disease Control says the average American woman is going to have 1.6 children over the course of her lifetime. And that's a pretty significant drop from where we were 50 years ago.
Yes, correct. I think since the 1970s, it's dropped precipitously. So we've seen a huge shift in the number of children a woman has.
And that, you know, when you think about it logically, means that there are fewer grandparents than we've had before. About one in three adults over 50 doesn't have a grandchild now, which is very different than it was 50 years ago.
Yes, correct.
So I wonder, how has this upended the expectations that older Americans have about what their later years will look like?
I think for a lot of grandparents, what I've heard has been some disappointment. I think when you have children, there's this expectation that grandchildren will come as well, because all of our past generations have had grandchildren, right? And it's that whole idea of, you know, you get to spoil the kids and send them home. It's this kind of parenting without the harsh part of it, right? Without the discipline, and you get to spoil the child and not have to deal with some of the consequences or the more negative behaviors. And so I think that's really where that sentiment is coming from.
You know, when couples can't conceive, they are told to mourn the loss, that it's okay to grieve the life that you thought you were going to have. It's incredibly difficult to move past infertility. Mm-hmm. I wonder if, on a smaller scale, the same advice is true for people who really wanted to be grandparents, to grieve the loss, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It does make sense to me. I think it could probably be a really healthy way of dealing with this expectation that might not actually come to fruition.
We also want to hear from you this hour. Are you someone who's chosen not to have children and are getting pressure from your parents? Are you hoping for grandchildren? Are you okay with never having them? You can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides@wosu.org. You know, I also think the role grandparents play in the lives of their grandchildren is also changing. Baby boomers are more active, less likely to babysit than previous generations. And I wonder if some of that is also changing the decision to have children, because, you know, grandma's got a whole active life and she's not going to be able to help with the childcare.
Right. That's a very good point. And, you know, we've actually seen, we've seen increases in the age of retirement. So we know that both men and women who are parents are retiring later. So it's not even that they have these active social lives. Many of them are still in the workforce. And even if they've retired from their primary job, many of them go back to work, whether part-time or full-time. And that really makes it difficult for them to be that second parent to the child.
Also, people are just choosing to have children. Oh, bless you. People are just choosing to have children later in life. You know, instead of having your first baby at 22, you might be 32. For a lot of women, it's also 42, which also changes the age at which your parents just become grandparents.
Yes, exactly. And that's a lot of why it's hard to even track some of these things, right? So we actually, as family demographers, often have to wait until a woman gets through their years of fertility before we can even determine whether or not they're done. And with different technologies as they have progressed, women can have children a little bit longer, right? On average, than we might have used to seen. In any of the growth that we've really seen, infertility tends to be at the older age group. So that supports that idea. And then those changes trickle down slowly, right, to the next generation. So it might take 20, 30, 40, 50 years of data and people's lived lives before we can actually see how these trends play out and what those repercussions are. So that's one important point I think about what we're seeing now, is that this decrease in the share of not only people having parents, but becoming grandparents is actually happened, when the baby boomers were deciding or not deciding how many children that they were going to have.
Yeah, I want to take a call from Joanne in Columbus, who has grandchildren but doesn't live near them. And I think this is an interesting point. Welcome to All Sides, Joanne.
Yes, my grandchildren mostly live in Colorado, one in Boston, Massachusetts, but and some of them are older, but two of them are younger. And when we Skype, they're interested for a few minutes, and then they don't want to sit, And so I mean, it's really tough. I only get out there maybe once a year or something like that, and it's really tough not to be a part of their lives as the one of them is going to be a teenager.
Thanks, Joanne. I do think that has another factor in it. We are living further away from home. We are moving away from community. And that not only impacts your decision to have children, it impacts the access that a grandparent might even have to a child the way they did 50, 60, 100 years ago. Also, Krista, I totally sympathize. I'm getting over a cold
I'm
myself,
sorry.
so it's going around. But yeah, that distance that we put between us and our parents can really impact how they get to be grandparents.
Definitely. And again, I'm the data geek here. So the data really, shows that we've seen a lot of movement, not only across country, but from the types of neighborhoods that we live in, right? So
Oh, I think we're having a little bit of
experience.
technical difficulty there. We lost you there for a
Sorry.
second. But yeah, I think the data is fascinating that we're like living further away from our birthplace. You look 100, 200 years ago, most people lived within a couple of miles of where they were born.
Yes, and they were living in rural communities. They were living on farms. Very different than what we see today with people living in suburban and more urban areas.
How are older Americans starting to think about their legacy in the context of not having grandchildren? I wonder if that's something we're starting to look at yet.
Not in my work that I've seen. But then again, most of what I do is quantitative. But I do think there's that sense that there's most of what I look at is it's this idea of lack of connection to community. These in public health, they call them deaths of despair. We see an increase in reported loneliness. We see an increasing rate of older Americans living alone. And I think those trends kind of underlie what you're trying to get at here, is that there is the sense that, if there aren't children or grandchildren, what is my legacy? What am I leaving behind if I'm not leaving another human, I guess?
It can be a very biological feeling, probably.
Yes.
I want to take a call from Jason in Columbus. Welcome to All Sides.
Hello, like I was saying earlier, my name is Jason. I'm 27 years old. I did not go to college. I've been with my girlfriend for 7 years. We're both tradesmen and women, and we feel that we can't have the children because of the state of the economy that it's in right now. We've been renting, looking for a home for the past few years. We put that on hold. And so if we don't really have a home or a kind of a stable situation there, why would we bring children into it?
Yeah, the cost of children is, we've done shows on it, we've talked about it. At the peak of childcare for me, I have two daughters. We did not have a third, and one of those reasons was economic. But yeah, at the peak of childcare, we were paying $35,000 a year. I mean, it is not cheap to have a kid. And I think it definitely impacts people's decision to have just one, to have none, to have them much later in life.
Yes, very much. There's a survey out. It's called Money in the Future. And they ask high school seniors about their expectations, about whether they want to get married or have children. And what we've seen is we've seen an increase in recent years. This has been done since the 1970s, is that a growing share are saying, one, they don't want to get married. And two, they don't want to have children. But the biggest increase we've seen, particularly since the pandemic, is this increasing range or percentage that say they aren't sure, which I think is really interesting. And when we dig deep and do some qualitative work with them, many of them look at becoming a parent as selfish. They're really afraid to bring a child into what they see as a very problematic or troubling world. And so, and they're worried about being able to provide for that child the way they were provided for, or possibly provide better for their own children than they were provided for. So whereas the grandparent might see this as a selfish act, or potential grandparent might see this as a selfish act to not provide them with grandchildren, their children might have a completely different perspective on this. They might see it as being selfish by bringing a child into the world.
We're not the only country experiencing declining birth rates, right? When we look at the rest of the world, people are just having fewer kids, or first world countries are having fewer children.
Generally, yes, that is the truth. Most have been below replacement level fertility for quite a long time. They actually hit below replacement level fertility before the United States did. France is one of the countries, they're still below replacement level, but they have like 1.8, so they're a little bit higher. But the French government has put a lot of effort, a lot of money and time and investment into their early childhood programming and maternal and paternal care. So some economists feel that might be what's driving that. But generally speaking, yes, developed countries have had below replacement level fertility for quite a while.
And that is a very tricky thing to probably navigate, especially as somebody who looks at statistics and demography of like what government programs could actually incentivize us to have more children.
Yes. And a lot of that conversation happens here in the United States, and it becomes even more difficult in the U.S. because not all of our, so much of our government is local government or state government. So the federal government has supreme power, but they only do so much. And it becomes very difficult to see how these different policies might impact individual lives, because one, you need to control for all these different types of policies, because theoretically every state could do something different.
That makes it easy to study.
Oh, yes, it does.
Yeah, I know. You guys just really love all the variables.
We sure do. Makes it interesting.
I want to remind everyone that we want to hear from you this hour. Are you somebody who's chosen not to become a parent? Has that been a difficult conversation between you and your own parent? Are you a grandparent hoping to be, or made peace with being, you know, a grandparent to a granddog? Give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides@wosu.org. We're going to take a quick break, but Krista is going to stick around, and we're going to talk about those thorny conversations around becoming or not becoming grandparents. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking about becoming, or perhaps not becoming, grandparents this hour as the number of Americans having children continues to decline. Still with us is Krista Westrick Payne, the Assistant Director of the National Center for Family and Marriage Research at Bowling Green State University. I wonder, Krista, how are older adults redefining their identities in the absence of grandchildren? Are we starting to see just shifts in the way they look at what the last decades of their life will look like?
I think that is probably, I mean, what is having to happen. Some of these individuals may not have even perceived that this would be something that they would have to navigate. I think about, you know, grandchildren and just children in general, how much they influence our social networks, right? So when you have children, often it keeps you tied to a community because so much of that tie is around schools. And, you know, we find that, you know, many times your adult friend groups have to do with the different parents of the children your children go to school with. And when those connections get severed, or once your children, you know, graduate or leave and move away, that connection gets severed. But then if you have local grandchildren, you reconnect, right? And you're pulled back into the community, you're pulled back into those connections. And without the grandchildren there, you lose out on that kind of second, I don't want to say second wind, but that second level of experience with that particular institution. Another one is church. We've seen a huge decline in church attendance, which is another way that Americans have formed their communities and maintained their communities and their connections over time. So that's another another social network that seems to be severed. So when you lose those opportunities, you lose the ease at which you're able to continue to make connections with other individuals. So it does make your life look very different. So instead of going to the football or basketball game on Friday night, what are you going to do? You know, are you going to sit at home, or are you going to reach out and try to talk to that friend or make plans? It takes a little more effort on your part, right?
Yeah. I want to take a call from Denise in Coshocton, who has three adult children, but none of them have had grandchildren. Welcome to All Sides, Denise.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I am glad. Thank you for taking my call. I am 63. And I have three adult children. The oldest is 38. The second one is 37. And the youngest is 30. So I don't have any grandchildren yet. However, only one of my children is married, and that is the youngest one. The other two oldest are not even married. So I think a lot of the postponement for children is because of the marriage age is also increasing. People are getting married a lot later. And so, you know, the oncoming of grandchildren is pushed back as well. But at 63, I officially retired at 62, and I stay very busy, very active. And I think there's just a level of personal creativity, you know, to keep your life interesting and, you know, going forward. As your guest mentioned, that retirement is a lot different. A lot of people are still working. So even though I am retired, I do stay quite busy. And I don't have the, I guess, longing so much for grandchildren as I might have, you know, if my children were, you know, not married. So that was my point I wanted to make.
Thank you so much, Denise. Sounds like she is navigating this quite well.
Yes, it does. It's a really good point, Denise, about the increased age at marriage. So even though we have a growing share of people do have their births outside of marriage, we still see a large proportion happening within marriage. And when you delay marriage, if that's important to you, you're also going to probably delay childbearing. And the age at first birth for women has increased also over time. So that has, yes, definitely a lot to do with it. And for women, we have a finite amount of years that we can actually have children. So even though we might have, you know, increases in the share of women that might not have a child, that wasn't necessarily by choice. So there's this idea of fertility foregone, where they might have wanted or intended to have children, but after they did what they did with their career and tried to find the relationship, they might be to a point where it's no longer feasible for them. So a lot of things go into this.
I have a sort of big picture question for you. What role do grandparents play in, like, the family structure and within society?
Well, what's really fascinating to me is that humans are one of the only species where the women live for a length of time after they're able to reproduce, which I think is pretty cool. I think that makes, you know, if you get to be a grandparent, that's pretty spectacular. There's something interesting biologically about humans. So for whatever reason, they have the potential to experience a life stage that other organisms might not be able to have. And I think it can be a very supportive role. And a lot of it too has to deal with parenting, right? So we've even seen shifts in the type of parenting styles. And we've seen dramatic shifts just within the last 100 to 150 years. So I think maybe at one point, maybe a grandparent was very active, like a parent was in more of the authoritative type things with discipline and keeping an eye on them. And grandparents were helping out, not with just children, but with other things in the household, other chores. And now I think it's more of a quality over quantity type of thing. So the type of interactions are more probably having to do with emotional, socio-emotional things, having intimate relationships, more nurturing types of relationships, as opposed to giving necessary. And it's going to change with the child's age, right? Because the child needs different things based on how old they are. So when the child's young, a grandparent might provide instrumental help, like helping feed the baby, giving, you know, the parents a night off. Whereas once they get a little bit older, it's going to be more about attending those things that the children really love, like a sporting event. So the nature of the relationship is also going to change as the child's age changes.
I want to take a call from Jan in Dublin. Welcome to All Sides, Jan.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So my daughter's 36. I retired 2 years ago. She doesn't have children. But what I've been hearing from her and many of her friends who also don't have children is that they're really concerned about climate change and the future of our planet. And you had mentioned earlier that many of the younger people feel like it's selfish to have a child. And I'm thinking that this may play into that a bit.
You know, that's a good point. I've heard that too. Have you heard that, Krista?
Yes, we have, particularly with our young adults who are in college. And I have a 20-year-old son, and this is something that he and his friends have talked about also. It's a real concern. You know, I've heard the term dumpster fire thrown out. I know, like they're very concerned about climate change. And I mean, they're even concerned as to whether or not they're going to have a planet to live on once they get to old age.
You know, I think it's because having a child is an inherently hopeful act.
It is. That's a very good point.
You are hoping for a future here, yes, on planet Earth. And I think that requires hope, not only that you can feed them and care for them and hope that, yes, they will be loved and feel safe, but hope that they will have a future to grow into.
Yes. Yes. I 100% agree.
Are we getting like just more pessimistic as a people? That's kind of sad to think about, but
yeah, we might be. I mean, and it's hard, right? Because of just the inundated social net, you know, the social media and news. And it's not all bad, right? Like, it's great that we can find out so much, but at the same time, the amount that we're bombarded with on a daily basis, you know, I can see it can be very overwhelming.
It feels like if you look at the last 50 years of family demographics, there's just been sweeping massive changes from, you know, divorce rates to two-parent income households to child care. Like, it's just, it feels like the entire way that we conceive of family as Americans is flip-flopped in like 50 years, which is wild.
It is wild. And what's interesting, though, is a lot of people refer to, right, that 50s, you know, 50 year, they like to think of the 1950s. As this panacea, this glory days of the family. And actually, when you look at, you know, the work of family historians, that 1950s, that ideal that Americans have a tendency to hold up, is actually just a blip on the page of what family looked like over the entire existence of humans that we know it, right? So, and I understand, because we tend to idealize, you know, it has a lot to do with our age, right? Looking back. But really, and yes, we have seen a lot of change, right? And a lot of that has been brought about by technology. And, you know, we've seen increasing cohabitation rates. We've seen marriage rates decline. Divorce actually was growing very dramatically up until the late 1970s, early 80s. And what most people don't know is the divorce rate has actually dropped since the early 1980s. Yes. If you look at the crude rate, I could get really technical on that. But
I mean, that's a little reassuring. We're also getting married less. So maybe people are figuring out whether they really want to do it now.
Yeah. So that's something we talk about as selecting in the marriage. So we find that fewer people are choosing to get married. And even marriage itself, right? So everybody just used to assume they were going to get married. Like it was the thing that everybody did. And they didn't really, quote unquote, think so much about it. It was so normative. And now it's almost as if marriage has become this next level of achievement, right? So you have to have so many things in place before you can actually decide to get married. So it's not even really, it's become more of an achieved status as opposed to a default status, which is very interesting. That is something that has changed dramatically in the last 50 years.
I want to take a call from Sarah in London, Ohio. Welcome to All Sides, Sarah.
Hi. I was just kind of bringing a perspective from an almost 40-year-old, but I got married 10 years ago and never really had the urge, my husband and I, to have children. We always thought that if we did, we would embrace, you know, that next chapter in our life. But my mom adopted me when I was 3 days old. She had three ectopic pregnancies, and she and my father could never have children. So that was a pull for her on, you know, her perspective, wanting to have grandkids, obviously, later on because she had children. And that was a topic of discussion that happened with her and I early on. And she's kind of gotten to the point where she understands that, you know, it's a personal choice. You know, my husband and I have a lot of stuff like anxiety, depression, Tourette's syndrome, things that we didn't necessarily want to pass down to children. And so that was just a, you know, topic of discussion that I thought, you know, with mental health being so prevalent nowadays, just holding back and making decisions maybe for a child that wouldn't be so, you know, well off, you know, in today's world.
You know, Sarah, thank you for sharing that. I do think I'm glad that you got to a place of understanding with your mother, because it doesn't always go that way. Like, people can get surprisingly boundary stomping about the desire for grandchildren. It's, I'm glad that it is worked out. I wonder, Krista, what other demographic changes are you seeing that you think are going to have an impact down the road?
Oh, man. You know, one thing, some of the work I've been doing lately has a lot to do. We talked earlier about policies, right? So a lot of the work I'm doing now is I'm looking at the effect of policy on family formation. And there's a lot of ideas out there of different policies to try to promote marriage, trying to promote fertility and different things. And while the ideas might be good, I don't think we really know what the lasting impact of those policies might be. And so I really wonder, moving forward, depending on, you know, who's elected and who's not, what we're going to see. And as our country seems to almost bifurcate, I'm wondering if we're going to see a lot more differences by states. As different, I mentioned before, how states really have a lot of power over the policies that they can implement. And we do, we're starting to find in some of our work that's not published yet, but we're working on it, that these policies you know, influence where people choose to live and raise their families. And so I'm really curious to see moving forward how that might reshape our country and the possible impacts that might have moving forward.
You know, if I think about it, most of the families I know that have large families, like, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 kids, they're all deeply religious people.
Yeah, they are. They are very much so. And many of those larger families tend to be in more rural areas. Not necessarily, you know, it depends on the state that you're looking at. You know, you do see some more suburban and urbanized areas, larger metro areas that do have larger shares of more large family friendly religious groups. But yeah, And that's the other thing is this rural urban duality, right, that's going on. And so and following the pandemic, we saw a little bit of a pullback from those more metro areas. People, started to move out. But I think that's going to reverse. We're starting to see people moving back into the city. People's policies are changing. They don't really want people doing the telework. Many people are saying, no, you have to be in the office 5 days a week. So I think that previous trends that we saw are going to kind of come back into play. And I really don't anticipate, given any huge major global or national events, I don't really see a huge reversal in those trends. I just think we're going to continue to see what we've seen here in the past 20 years to continue.
And if you want to join the conversation about if you have children, if you chose not to have children, if you're grieving the loss of grandchildren, or whether you are perfectly happy with your life the way that it is right now, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides at wosu.org. I think, I wonder how. I don't know, actually, this may be beyond the scope of your research, but
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and ask. I wonder whether you've looked at how older adults perceive the societal implications of fewer children being born.
That I can't really speak to. I'm not really sure. I mean, I've read anecdotal accounts, and I've read stuff done, I've read things in the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, different things. I think there is, among certain populations in the United States, I think there's a little bit of an underlying fear that things are changing and changing in a way that, they might feel our country might look very different, in the coming decades. And but I don't think everybody feels that way.
No, because there are real macroeconomic impacts to a smaller generation, just in terms of Social Security solvency and other, like, if there's less people paying in, if we have an economy and school, colleges and jobs built around having a certain number of workers and then we have less, there are, like, real world economic impacts to a smaller generation.
There are, and for academia, because that's where I work, we refer to it as a demographic cliff that we're approaching, right? So even though the baby boomer generation had fewer children of their own compared to their children, they were so large, we didn't feel nationally, we didn't feel the pinch, right? But now, as we've heard, as they are starting to retire and getting older, Social Security is being strained. And then the millennial generation is actually quite large too, because even though the boomers had fewer kids, there were still a lot of them. So it's really as the millennial generation moves into, and we're missing out Gen X, right? My generation. They just get swept under the rug. But as the millennial generation start moving into, parenthood and eventually grandparenthood, the numbers start, it's an exponential reduction, right? As opposed to growth. And there's just not going to be the numbers. And we can even see it like in rural communities. Mine, as an example, I currently live where I grew up, very small rural town, graduated with 43 people, which most people can't even wrap their
Oh
heads
my
around.
goodness.
I know it was a public school. My children have attended that school, and my youngest, who's nine, there's 26 children in her whole grade. Yeah. Now, but then when I look at our county and the neighboring counties, because that's a lot of what my work does, is I look at place and how different characteristics of where you live might influence your family life. We're seeing those reductions similarly, where classes are being cut by half, by 40%, when you don't have consolidation across school districts. And so where once they were busing in mobile homes to, to and kids were going to school at mobile homes because the buildings weren't big enough. Now, they're not even using all their classrooms. So it is a huge shift. It is a huge change. We don't have enough workers to fill some of the what we would consider entry-level positions. I work on a number of community health improvement working groups. And from an economic perspective, we do a lot of manufacturing here in Northwest Ohio. And they just can't get the workers. And they can't get them to stay, and they're trying to stay competitive with, paying them a living wage, But when, you know, you have these factories that have been there for so long and the workforce has changed so dramatically and they can't stay solvent. So then they move on or they close their doors.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation because one of the ways they're filling it is through immigration from other countries. And that's a whole can of worms, especially in the last couple of weeks.
It is. But it all has, like you pointed out, though, it all has an impact. It all has this bigger effect than what you might experience in your own lived life. And I think that's what's the hardest part, right?
Yeah.
Like you're sitting there maybe as a person of grandparent age, you know, lamenting the fact that you don't have grandparents, but, you know, taking it up to the next level, you know, there's, you know, far-reaching, you know, implications.
That was Krista Westrick Payne, the Assistant Director of the National Center for Family and Marriage Research at Bowling Green State University. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Yeah.
And I hope you feel better soon.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're talking about what happens when grandparents become parents again. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking about grandparenting this hour. Because fewer people are becoming parents, as fewer parents are choosing to have children, there are still families where grandparents have become the primary caregivers for their grandchildren. In fact, research shows that children do better with family members, usually grandparents, when they need to be removed from the home. Joining us now is Barbara Turprin, a board member for the Ohio Grandparent Kinship Coalition. It's a nonprofit advocacy organization for kinship caregivers. Barbara, welcome to All Sides.
Good morning. Thank you, Anna, for having me.
So Ohio lawmakers created the Kinship Support Program, and Governor DeWine signed it into law in 2020. Can you just explain a little bit how the program works?
The Kinship Support Program specifically is implemented to support families who are involved with the child welfare system. That is when children are taken from their parents for a variety of reasons and come into the child welfare agency in the county. That agency is mandated to first look for relative caregivers or caregivers who are close to the family as a placement for that child. And so when they do locate a kinship caregiver to place that child in that caregiver's home, then there's an opportunity for that caregiver to receive a monthly payment for that child in lieu of getting the Ohio Works First, the monthly TANF payment. And it is a payment per child, and I believe it's around $400 a month per child that's in that caregiver's home. But tied to that is also, it's a time limited payment. And at the end of the time limits, the caregiver is given an option to either go through a licensure procedure process in order to become a licensed kinship foster parent. Or if they choose not to, then they go back to the Ohio Works First monthly TANF payment, which is lesser. And for each child after their first one, it's a reduced amount. And so they are given that option. And it basically is supporting the foster care system for those children that are in the custody of a child welfare agency.
Yeah. And it makes logical sense, right? There are financial burdens to raising children. And traditional foster families have had this assistance for a long time. But kinship care, where you're with a relative, was kind of left out of it for a while. It was like a hole in the system where, yeah, you could absolutely take the kids, but there wasn't that same structure of financial support.
That's correct. And the majority of children are not in the care of child welfare systems that are placed with kinship families. Probably about 3,000 to 4,000 within the state right now are placed with kinship families. But the one thing that our organization really doesn't feel should be required of families in order to get support is to become licensed. We don't feel the licensure process is necessary for a kinship family to go through in order to become or to be able to be supported adequately and fairly, just as well as foster parents.
Can I ask what kind of legal considerations should grandparents be aware of before they enter into these agreements, particularly if they are going to do it informally outside the system?
Right. Yeah, that is a pretty complicated process and issues for grandparents, because a lot of them aren't familiar with the legal system. There is not a lot of legal help for grandparents unless they may qualify for legal public assistance through legal aid. And a lot of that is based on income, and they're not qualified for that. So it is confusing as to what they do. A lot of times the informal situation is the parent, for whatever reason, drops the child off with the grandparent or the relative and is not able to come back and care for them. And so that grandparent is, you know, pretty much caught in the middle of a situation to know what legal rights do they have, what do they do. Now, the Ohio Grandparent Kinship Coalition has asked a bill to be introduced here to extend the power of attorney that is currently in effect for grandparents only to all other caregivers that take children into their care. And there's a power of attorney that a parent can authorize the grandparent or the caregiver to have a legal ability to enroll the child in school and get health care. And right now we are requesting that legislation be implemented to extend that to all caregivers. Other legal options that caregivers have is to go through court and get legal custody of the child. And that way, if the parent isn't willing to or isn't around to give them the power of attorney, then they can go to court and get that legal custody, so they are able to get the educational services and healthcare services for the child.
Yeah, and that can be complicated, especially if you are in communication with your child, the biological parent, during this kind of very complicated transition.
That's correct. It creates a relational sort of tension there with the grandparent becoming the parent and having the parental responsibilities for that child. But if the parent is still in the life of that child, trying to maybe get their lives back together and get the child back, there is a conflict there. And that's something that families have to really work through and decide how that's going to work for the child, because the child is then caught in the middle. And sometimes, I mean, a lot of grandparents now are getting their children into trauma-informed therapy. The grandparents or the relative caregivers are going through therapy themselves. And hopefully the parents, if they're involved with the child, are also accessing therapy for these situations.
I was going to ask how caring for their grandchildren or a younger relative is impacting their mental and physical health. Because sometimes you don't, like, you want to take the kid because it's the right thing to do and they're in a very difficult spot, but you don't realize how hard that's going to be.
I talk to grandparents fairly regularly and kinship caregivers fairly regularly. A lot of them do say that it is an emotional strain. It's a physical strain, especially if they weren't counting on or even anticipating a child being placed with them in the later years of their life, where their plans were mostly for themselves as individuals, or maybe a couple. And so it is an emotional strain. And a lot of times there's no respite for them. And that's one of the big issues that I hear, that because they don't want the child to be traumatized anymore. They are really concerned about where that child goes if that child has to be taken care of outside of their home. And they don't trust, you know, a lot of people to be able to deal with that child's issues. So they are very conscientious about what happens to that child, but they take on so much of that that they don't, sometimes they overlook their needs too, and it becomes a very stressful situation.
Yeah, the U.S. Surgeon General last month actually issued this warning that parenting can be harmful to your mental health. It was, I mean, I know it made a lot of headlines, but it is true. Like, I have no regrets about having my daughters. They are amazing humans, but it is hard. It is undeniably harder than I thought it was going to be.
Definitely. And your support system is very important when there are children involved. And many caregivers don't have that support system because the family has sort of either fallen apart or become divided over situations. And a lot of them just don't have anybody to step up. So they don't trust anybody outside that family situation to care for their children.
What advice do you offer to grandparents who are just starting their kinship care journey?
Mm-hmm. My advice is to reach out, to connect with the social services agencies in their area. Our organization, we have a wonderful website, the Ohio Grandparent Kinship Coalition. If you just put that in as into your search engine, will pop up. And if they go to our website and they subscribe to our website, then we will send them all kinds of information about meetings, events that are coming up. We're having an advocacy month event right now for caregivers. So if they go to that, they can find out about support groups. There's a statewide support group that's available. And that's really a key, is to connect with other caregivers. Over the past weekend, the support group had a local event for caregivers. They brought the caregivers together with the kids. We had a big picnic for them. We had games and prizes and fun food and everything that it gave the caregivers the time to relax and not worry about the kids, because the kids were being taken care of. And so it was a great event, and the caregivers love it every year. So there is an online support group. I suggest they go to our website, and it's the information is there, and they can contact OGKC, and I'd be willing to help connect them with any resources that they need.
Yeah, I think that's a good point about building community, because I think some of your strongest friendships are forged when you're all young parents together. You're in the thick of this. Mm-hmm. And for a grandparent taking on a child, probably most of their friends are no longer in this stage. It's like being the very first among your friends group to have a child.
Right. And they have to sacrifice those relationships and the things that they did, those activities they did with those friends that they had, because they don't have the opportunity just to up and go to the movies in the afternoon or go to lunch, go out for an evening event. It's not available to them anymore because of that responsibility. But in talking to grandparents and caregivers, they would not trade that option for not being able to care for those grandchildren.
So you talked about one legal change that you would like to see. Is there anything else that you think the state of Ohio could do to better support kinship care?
Well, yes, we have a long list of, like I said, we're having an advocacy month and contacting legislators this month with those, definitely with those kind of asks. Interestingly, 24 years ago, there was a report that went to the General Assembly on grandparents raising grandchildren. And in that report, there were needs identified, as well as, ways to deal with those needs. And 24 years later, basically those same needs are there. What they need is financial support, help with legal assistance, child care assistance, mental health support, and food care costs. Their child care and food assistance is based on income, and that makes it hard for a lot of caregivers who are still in the workforce. They're over income, but they still can't afford to take on the extra mouths, and they can't afford to have a child and pay child care. And I've had caregivers say they've had to quit their jobs in order, because of the child care costs, and that then puts them, behind a financial situation where there's a greater cost to them than it is the community. And that's the other thing. People may not realize that the caregivers save the state a lot of money in terms of not having to pay for these children to be in foster care. It's about 6% of the cost of what it is in foster care for children. And so and the benefits to the child, the benefits to the state are really outweighing the benefits that are provided to the caregivers.
That was Barbara Turpin, board member for the Ohio Grandparent Kinship Coalition. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you for having us, Anna. Take care.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides, right here on 89.7 NPR News.